about various objects which are important for general relativity. We have already started doing that, and we started with the key thing, the central issue here, what is a manifold? And of course, the space-time, our space-time will be a manifold, and space-time with a black hole will be a manifold up to some singularity and stuff like that. So anyway, so manifold in n dimensions, very intuitively, it's simply an object like this, which composes, it can have some holes or it can have some weird things, but always locally, it looks like R to the n, okay? And so basically it's a set of points, and then there are subsets of these points, and so each point on that manifold belongs to at least one of these subsets. So let's say this belongs to O alpha subset. And then, so it's my point P, and that's true for every point P. And then each of these subsets is equipped with a map or coordinate system, if you want, which maps this neighborhood of that point to some open neighborhood of R to the n. So that will be U alpha, and that will be the image of P, psi alpha, that's our map, psi alpha of P is this image of that point, and then there will be some neighborhood mapped by this psi alpha, and it's your given coordinate system, right? And so, for example, you can think about Rindle coordinate system, or you can think about Minkowski coordinate system or whatever, and you see that Minkowski coordinate system covers the whole manifold, but the Rindle coordinate system covers only part of that. So typically, if you have general manifold, you won't be able to find one coordinate system which would cover everything, okay? So typically you need more coordinate systems. And if that happens, and that point P also belongs to some O beta, then there is another map, psi beta, which goes to, again, R to the n, okay? And then this is my U beta. And this is the image of that point, psi beta of P, okay? But what you also require is that, you know, these coordinate systems, they have one coordinate system, you have another coordinate system, is that they are connected by C infinity map. So if you go from here to there, this is C infinity map from R to the n to R to the n, right? And of course, what this map is that first you map from here to the manifold by using psi alpha to minus 1. Now you are back at the manifold, and then you use psi beta. Okay? And of course, this is only good when, you know, when there is an overlap. So for this overlap region where the two coordinate systems sort of overlap, right? So only then for that region you require that this map is C infinity. And so you know, this the fact that you have your manifold equipped with these maps, which always map to the R to the n, allows you to basically map everything what's happening on the manifold to the normal multidimensional calculus as you know it from basic mass courses. Let me also say that sometimes people like to visualize how the manifold looks like by embedding it into some higher dimensional space. So let's say I have a sphere S2, and I want to see how that looks like in the Euclidean space in three dimensions. Then I really draw the sphere living in the three-dimensional space as we know it. And so then I can imagine how, you know, the manifold sort of looks like in this three-dimensional space. So sometimes this is useful. It's mostly useful for your intuition. You don't really need it for any calculations, okay? So it's just good for your intuition to see, like, what the geometry might look like if I embed it in Euclidean space. Or sometimes it's not possible to embed in Euclidean space, so you embed in Minkowski space or whatever other space, right? And so there are also some embedding theorems. Maybe you've seen the movie Beautiful Mind by John Nash, and he has written down some embedding theorems. He says, like, you know, what are the conditions so that I can embed my manifold in a given manifold and so on? And is it always possible? And what is the dimensionality of the manifold I have to embed in and stuff like that? Okay, so that's good. That's called embedding theorems. Again, it's not really needed for whatever you are doing on the manifold, okay? Questions? Okay, so now we have our manifold, our space-time, and we better start putting some objects on that manifold. And the simplest object is the function. More generally, we want to put some tensors. And tensors are invariant objects. That live on the manifold. And what it basically means is that if you start choosing different coordinate systems, if you start choosing different coordinate maps, these objects remain invariant. And that's good, because that means that physics is independent of what kind of coordinates I am using. Okay? And so that's like a very, very good requirement you want to have. And of course, the simplest one is a scalar function. Scalar function. So which, if you take a point, it maps to a real number. And it's super simple. You just take that point P here, and you assign some number f of p. And this number better not be dependent on, you know, if I am choosing, you know, this map here, or if I'm choosing that map there. Right, so this number better be independent of that, which means f of psi of p, but let's be a physicist, and let's, instead of psi, sometimes people use x, right, the coordinate system, x and x prime, whatever, right? So f of x of p must be the same as f prime x prime of p, because it's still the same value of that function, you're just describing from two coordinate systems. Right, and so people write that as a transformation rule for a scalar field, that f of x is f prime at x prime. Okay, so this is how scalar function transforms. And basically what you have to do, let's say you have the value of the function in Cartesian coordinates, and in order to get f prime, you just transform these Cartesian coordinates to, say, spherical coordinates, but evaluate them at the same point, and that's how we all f prime will look like, but of course, if I evaluate it the same, I get the same number. Okay. So all you have to do is just plug in the, you know, do the transformation of x to x prime, plug in the, you know, the same point, and that's how you get the function in the new coordinate system. All right. So that's what happens for scalar. Questions? Yes.
So does this function act on manifold or the space of functions which map the manifold to Rn?
So the function, so here I define it at a point as a number. So if it maps a point on the manifold, so it maps points on the manifold to real numbers, right? So for a given point, I get one number. But of course, the function better be defined everywhere on the manifold, right? So as I keep changing my point p, I will get different numbers.
So when you write f of x of p, is f, in one case, the domain of f is a manifold. And with f of x of p, that means its domain is Rn.
Because you use this coordinate system here to the end. So then again, you have this image of point p here. And let's say this is a coordinate system x, which you are using here. So what this is really is x of p. So I called it psi of p before, right? But now I'm changing my notation from psi, which is a mathematical notation, to x, which is a physics notation, right? And so you have x of p, this is my region, and then you assign to this point the number. So what you really have by using this map is you have a function which maps from r to the n to real numbers. Because you can always use these maps which automatically come with your manifold. So again, so you are translating everything into what you know in multidimensional calculus. You have function from R to the N to R, effectively. But the aim is to define it for the points on the manifold. Very good. More questions like that? Okay, so then second thing was a tangent vector. And so I was trying to convince you is that your notation, which you know from high school, actually means that you are implicitly here using the Cartesian coordinates or whatever the coordinates you are using here. But it's better to actually carry the notation which kind of coordinates you are using. And so then you actually associate with the vector rather the directional derivative. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between the vectors and the corresponding directional derivatives. Okay. And so instead of thinking about like having a vector here, I can think of like I'm taking a derivative along this vector there. And I am using the explicit coordinate system. So I'm using the coordinates x mu here, for example. And this thing here will really be independent of the coordinates, right? Because I can change coordinates, but the directional, how much I'm differentiating with respect to this direction remains the same independent of coordinates. Okay, so this is a directional derivative. And we know that directional derivative is a derivative, and so it is linear. So let's be more precise. So V at point P in the manifold, so tangent vector V at point P in your manifold will be a map. So V is a map which maps. So okay, so this directional derivative, what it is doing, right? So I can apply it to a function, okay? And if I differentiate that function along the vector v at a given point, I get a number, right? So I just make a derivative of that, evaluate at that point, I get a number. Of course, if I choose another point, I get a different number. Right? So if I actually run throughout the whole manifold, I change the points here, I map functions to functions on the manifold. Right? Because for each point, I will get a number. So anyway, so let's do it first at a point. So it's a map from functions to real numbers such that it is linear, which means that if you have number times a function plus number times a function g, which is that a times v of f plus b times v of g. So that's the linearity. So a and b are numbers, and f and g are functions. And then it's the Leibniz rule. So if you have two functions, f and g, you just differentiate the first one, and then you differentiate the second one. And that's your Leibniz rule. So now the first property is So both these properties are, of course, satisfied by a directional derivative. It's a derivative, so it satisfies both these properties, right? So operators which are directional derivatives will satisfy this. Why? Both of these are required for a vector, which very intuitively you want to have a vector space where you can add vectors and stuff like multiply the vectors by a number and stuff like that. Well, the first one is obvious. You want linearity, you want to be at vectors and so on. The second one is not so obvious, and somebody asked me why the second one. And to be honest, I have no idea. But there is one thing which actually is discussed in Vault, and I looked it up. And so what you want, for example, is that V acting on a constant will give you zero. Okay? So this will not be given by linearity only or by the Leibniz only. You need both properties to show that. Okay, so let's call this 1 and 2. So you have 1. And you have 2. So now, specifically, let's apply what is v on function which is equal to a constant. Okay? And intuitively, when you're applying derivative on a constant, you should get zero, right? So we are taking this as a definition, right? We are saying that the vector will satisfy these two things. So how do I prove that v on a constant is zero? Okay, so very good. So what you do is that you apply v on f square, okay? F equals to c. So what is v on f square? So I can use the first property. And I know that what this is it's a constant times f, okay? Because f is c, so I can write it this way. But this is just a constant. I can take it out. So this is c times v of f, which is c times v of c by using the property 1. Okay, I'm just using the linearity here. I'm taking this guy out, so c v of f, and then that's c v of c. But at the same time, I can be using property 2. So then I have v of f square, so I have to use the Leibniz rule, and I will have two terms. I will have f times v of f plus f times v of f. Well, now I use the fact that f is c, so I will have 2 times c v of c. Okay, and so you have an amazing equality. This is equal to c times v of c, is equal to 2 times c v of c, from which you can actually infer that v of c is equal to 0, as you would expect. So you need both properties to actually show that vector acting on a constant function actually gives you 0. Okay, so I don't know. Still doesn't fully motivate the Leibniz rule, but at least you know it is useful for something. Okay, so please take it as your homework. Why we expect Leibniz in more general to be valid for vectors, right? For directional derivatives, it's obvious. For vectors, well, we are saying vectors are directional derivatives, so it should be okay. So probably it's pointless homework. Anyway, questions? So now we know what a tangent vector is. Simply, it's a beast which eats functions and produces a real number at a point, or if you run around the whole manifold, it's a beast which eats functions and produces a new function on the manifold. So now, let me formulate a theorem, which I'm not going to prove, is that set of tangent vectors P forms a vector space which is called tangent vector space, a tangent vector space it is a vector space and it's called tangent vector space and it's denoted by T P M. So it's a tangent vector space at a given point P above the manifold M. Okay. So that's still not a theorem. So this is, well, it's a vector space which has the same dimensionality as the manifold M. So if you have n-dimensional manifold, and this TPM will also be n-dimensional, it's very intuitive, right? Everything locally looks like R to the n. So if I make a tangent space to that, it also looks like R to the n, right? and has something which is called coordinate basis. D over dx mu. So these are the basis vectors of the tangent vector space. And then any V which belongs to this TPM can be written as a linear combination of these basis vectors. Can be written as V equals to V mu D over DX mu. Well, these are the components of that vector, and this is the basis. So that's the theorem, which is very intuitive, but I'm not going to prove it. So let's say that we have a example. What you should be thinking about, like, let's say you have a sphere that's your manifold. So M is S2, okay? So then you take a point P there on that S2. So that's my P. And then you run a tangent space to this, a tangent plane, which is tangent to S2 at that point P, okay? So you'll get something like this, which is now, okay, so this is my sphere here. Now, this is my sphere. Now I have my tangent space, which is touching that sphere at that point P. So this is my tangent space TP of M, where my vectors will live in the TP of M, okay? Because it's a plane, it's obvious that everything will be linear and nice and stuff like that, right? I can add vectors in a plane and no problem whatsoever, right? But then, the statement is that I can choose the basis vectors in this tangent space. Well, okay, so there will be the theta direction, which goes something like this. So this will be d over d theta. And then I have a phi direction, which goes like that. So there will be d over d phi. So these are the two basis vectors which span my, so this is, this is TP of S2. So that's this plane here. And in that plane, I can choose two basis vectors. One is in the direction of theta. The other one is in the direction of phi. And so these are my two basis vectors. And then if I have any vector here, right? If I have any vector here, let's say the vector here goes like this. Well, I can definitely decompose it in the way that it's some component in this, you know, d phi direction, and it's some component in this d over d theta direction. And so this will be v phi. So our v is now v phi d over d phi plus v theta d over d theta, where the d over d phi and d over the d theta are the basis vectors, and these are just the components. How much I have to move in the d over d phi direction, how much I have to move in the theta direction. Okay. Questions? So that's what the vectors are. Super simple. So you always like run a tangent space your manifold at that given point, and tangent space is obviously vector space. I just have to choose a proper basis there, and then everything there will be just a linear combination of this basis. And the fact that they have the same dimensionality is sort of obvious, right? Because the neighborhood of P looks like R to the n, so the tangent space will also look like R to the n, very intuitively. Of course, if you are interested in the proof of this, you can look it up in various GR textbooks. Okay, so now what is very important is that Well, here I may be using my coordinates theta and phi, which will be the spherical coordinates. But equally well, although it's very stupid, I could be using Cartesian coordinates to describe what's happening on the surface of the sphere. Right? It will be much more complicated. Right? But nobody can prevent me doing that. So what happens when you change coordinates? What happens with this vector? Well, nothing. The vector is invariant object. The vector has to remain the same. So under change of coordinates, V remains invariant. Okay, but what does that mean? It means if I write it in one coordinate system, V mu d over dx mu, so that's how I write it in my coordinate system x. What happens when I write it in a coordinate system x prime? Well, I can use the chain rule because this is, in fact, a partial derivative, right? That's how we constructed it. It's like a partial derivative. It's a directional derivative. So this is a partial derivative. So I can use the chain rule on my partial derivative to see what happens in different coordinate system, right? And so this will be v mu d over, so now dx nu prime dx mu d over dx nu prime, okay? I just change coordinates from x to x prime. By the way, this is my horrible thing, so I never know where to put the primes. So people typically put the primes on x, so and then they put it sometimes on the index as well. So it's like they would be writing x prime, nu prime here, and so on. Okay, let's save this time and just put primes somewhere. And yeah, but anyway, it's a transformation from x to x prime of x, right? So that's what we are doing. Very good. So we use the chain rule. Now look at that. This thing here looks like the new basis in the prime coordinate system. If that is true, then whatever stands over here must be v nu prime. These are the components of the vector in this new coordinate system. And so we have a transformation rule, how the components transform. So if you want v nu prime is dx prime nu dx mu v mu. So that's how the components transform. The transformation of components of the vector. Right? So whereas the vector itself remains invariant under change of coordinates, the components don't, because the basis actually changes. Right? So I can say the basis changes, or I can say the components actually change.
David?
Yes?
I'm finding it difficult to take this partial derivative as a basis. Like, if I have a point of this manifold, what does this tell us? Like, it doesn't tell us the form of the basis.
Well, I don't know. So let's say Cartesian coordinates, right? I have coordinates x1 and coordinate x2. How do I make a direction that I want to move along x1? If I do a partial derivative along x1, definitely tells me I'm differentiating along this direction here. So d over dx1 is somehow related to the vector which is parallel to my x1 basis.
So we're implicitly assuming there to be like a position variable in front of this? We have like a position variable acting in front of this partial derivative.
Position the...
like in Cartesian coordinates, that would be like x, y, and z. So...
If you think about Cartesian coordinates, yes, this precisely... You would be doing something like this, right? So you would have x2, and then you have x1. And then if you want to move in the direction along x1, in this direction, you would be actually doing d over dx1. right? Or if you want to move along on this thing, you will be doing d over dx2, and so on. So really, this tells you like what the directions are, differentiation. But anyway, it's a direction, some kind of direction that you can create out of the coordinate system, right? And then you know the general vector will be just a linear combination of these two basis vectors. I mean, it's a little bit intuitive. It is intuitive. Whether it's yes.
I think about like this definition of vector space. It's good to think about it this way. Like it's not the actual tangent space, but like it's fully isomorphic to this space, and it has possibly more structure than the tangent space. It's also natural to generalize this way to general manifolds. So it's like fully isomorphic to what do you have imagined like vector spaces, and it has more structure. So that's.
That help for mathematically minded people, I guess. Thank you.
Also, I think that we can see because a translation is generated by momentum, and momentum is represented in space as a derivative in position. So,
okay, yeah, maybe that's a physical way to think about this. Maybe that's nice. Yeah, thank you. Well, very good. We have two explanations. Thank you. Very good. So this was still at the point P, right? But now I can extend the definition of this vector not only at point P, but I can extend it over the whole manifold, right? So then you will say, so then it's called a tangent vector field. Tangent vector field, which is basically a union of, you know, it's a set of V of P for all P belonging to M. All P that belongs to M, such that V of F is now a smooth function on M. Okay? So you require that, you know, the number which you get at this point and the number which you get at the nearby point, they don't differ that much. So they differ sort of smoothly, that you have a smooth function on this field. Okay, so basically you can again think about, well, I'll draw something. Well, okay. Let me draw something very incorrect. I don't know how to die. Well, okay, let's take the sphere again, right? So I have the one vector here, which lives in this tangent space here. And then if I move a little bit further, so that's at this point P. And then if I have another P, then there will be another tangent space here. But, you know, better, you know, these vectors sort of smoothly connect to form a vector field which is defined everywhere on the manifold. Okay. But notice also something which is very important for general relativity is that this vector v1 or v at p, and let's call this, I don't know, q. So p and q. So this is v at q. Although they are part of the same vector field on that manifold, v of p lives in this tangent space, and v of q lives in that tangent space, in its own tangent space. And in general, these two tangent spaces have nothing to do with each other, right? So for each point on the manifold, I have its own tangent vector space, and they are isomorphic, but they have, there's no way to identify them a priori unless there is some extra structure. Okay. Okay, and then because we had this TP of M, so then we have T of M, which is called tangent bundle. T of M, and it's a union of over all P of TP of M. Okay, so that's the set of all these, you know, tangent vector spaces which live over here. So now, if you want local coordinates on this T of M, So local coordinates, so this thing here, T of M, has local coordinates, which know about both, right? I have to tell first which point on the manifold I am at. Okay, so I have to specify what x mu is. So there will be x mu. So then I know where, which of the tangent spaces I'm thinking about. And then there will be the corresponding vector living at the tangent vector space. So that will be the components of that vector. So v nu. Okay, so it's basically a set of positions and velocities. Positions and vectors. Okay. Which maybe reminds you Lagrangian mechanics. Right? In Lagrangian mechanics, the Lagrangian is a function of positions and velocities. So actually, the Lagrangian, so you can describe classical mechanics in terms of differential geometry, and the Lagrangian will be a function on T of M. Questions? Yes.
When you define the vector field, what exactly is f? An arbitrary function on the manifold?
So it's like a union of all these things here. But what you require is that when you change this p, this vector doesn't change much. It changes smoothly, right? So really, it's a map. So b of f at a point is a number. But if I go to a different point, it will be a different number,
so
and so on.
F
is an arbitrary function, and so what you require that V of F is a nice, smooth function on the manifold as you run through all the points on that manifold. Okay, so now to make things a little bit more complicated, we now understand vectors, right? So now there is something which is called dual vectors. They're basically also vectors, but they look slightly different. Okay, so let me just make a definition. Yes?
Just to clarify, so we say V of F is smooth function. It means that just V, P, and V, Q are separately smooth. It doesn't mean that V, P, as you go from P to Q, V, P doesn't smoothly transform into V, Q. It doesn't mean that, right?
It means that.
Oh, it means that.
It means that because as you, so, you know, what I'm saying, so V, P, if you act on function f, it gives you one number, let's say one, right? Right? So then I have vq at that same function gives me a different number, two. Okay? If, you know, p and q are somehow, if I change them smoothly, right, I better get that the value of that function also smoothly changes.
Thank you.
Okay, so now basically the same structure, but it's called the dual vector. Okay, so definition. A, so this was a tangent vector, so now you can say cotangent vector. Or sometimes it's called dual vector. Or sometimes it's called a one-form. And probably you will find out many, many more notions. But OK, let's use the word cotangent vector. Let's call it omega at point P on the manifold is a map. Which likes to eat vectors and produces a number. Okay, so it maps a vector from TPM to a real number. Okay, so now let me join this definition with the theorem. So now the statement is that these cotangent vectors
form a cotangent vector space . So again, you know, they are basically vectors. So now this thing here is called TP star of M. So the star tells you that you are not talking about normal vectors, but you are talking about their dual vectors or cotangent vectors. And this thing here is a vector space. So it better has its own basis. And the basis for a given coordinate system is called dx mu, okay, with coordinate basis dx mu. And how do I define this coordinate basis? So dx mu is the simplest cotangent vector or covector or whatever. Right? So it's the simple dx mu is just I'm moving in the x mu direction. So it looks like a vector in this cotangent space in the x mu direction. But what it has to do? Well, it has to eat the corresponding vector and produce a number. So I can define what this dx mu basis is by requiring that when it acts on the basis of the other vector space, d over dx nu, it gives me delta mu nu. It gives me a number. Okay, so that's a definition of this coordinate basis dx mu. Yes?
Shouldn't we say that the map is linear? This linear map?
It's a linear map. Yes, of course, it must be a linear map. Yes.
Because we said it's a map. Oh, oh my God.
I think I'll be using linearity, so yeah, it's a linear map. Everything is linear, yes. Thanks. Thank you. And so correspondingly, I can write my cotangent vector omega as a linear combination of these basis vectors. So it will be given by omega mu dx mu, well, this is the basis, and this is the components. Okay. So this is how a general cotangent vector looks like. So how does the number look like, right? So we say, well, general cotangent vector eats a normal vector, produces a number. So how does that number look like? Okay, so we have omega acting on V. This better be a number. Well, what is this? So it's omega mu dx mu. Okay, omega mu is just a number. You don't care about that. So it's the basis which acts on your vector. So it's dx mu on V. Okay, so it's omega mu dx mu on v nu d over dx nu. So now the important property that it's linear, thank you for that, is, so I can take this, this is just a number, it's just a component. I don't care about it, I can take it out, it's linear, it's a number, right? So this is omega mu v nu dx mu acting on d over dx nu. By definition, this is delta mu nu. And so the number is just omega mu v mu. That's what the number is. So you know, so you have this very complicated definition of what, you know, a cotangent vector could be, but in some sense it's just another vector, but it has, you know, typically So the number vector will have index up, as you know it from special relativity. The cotangent vector will have index down. Okay? If you don't have metric, there's no way to translate one to another. These are independent vectors. They live in their own independent vector spaces. One lives in Tm, the other one lives in T star of m. Okay. If you have the metric, yes, I can write the index using the metric, g mu nu, and then I can map covectors to vectors and vice versa using the metric. But if you don't have the metric, these two are completely independent. There's no way you could map one to another. Okay? Questions? So now these as I said they from this cotangent vector space, or if you don't talk about a point, you can extend this to the whole of manifold, and then you have the cotangent bundle. So cotangent bundle T star of M, which is a union over of P of T star PM. And this thing here will have local coordinates. So this thing here will have local coordinates. Again, I have to tell where on the manifold I am. So it'll be x mu. But the other coordinate will be what kind of vector I have here. So the components of the vector omega, omega nu. Okay, but if we look at that prescription there, what is this omega nu? What you should be thinking, again, if you're thinking about classical mechanics, well, if this thing here is a position, this thing here is like a velocity, what is a dual to velocity? Something which is indexed down. It's the momentum, right? Very good. It's the momentum. So you can think about this thing here as a momentum, and then you see that cotangent bundle naturally describes Hamiltonian dynamics. So Hamiltonian will be a function which lives on this cotangent bundle and produces a number. Okay. So this is good for Hamiltonian mechanics. So now you really see that, you know, the velocities and the momenta, they live in two different spaces. So this is for Lagrangian mechanics. So the velocities, they live in the tangent bundle. They have index up. The momenta, they live in the cotangent bundle. They have index down. In general, there's no way to map one to another. Okay, well, there is. There is a Legendre transformation. Okay, which is a very complicated beast from the point of view of differential geometry. Because you have to map tangent to cotangent bundle, sort of. Okay. Anyway, so that's not important for us. So we have now cotangent vectors. Questions? Yes?
I think you mentioned that we need a metric to take cotangent vectors to vectors, right? So, you just now said that there is a Legendre transform as well. So can we see like there's a connection?
Well, that one probably has also metric in it. Yeah. So you know, you have this, what is it? When I'm mapping, for example, Lagrangian to Hamiltonian, as h minus pq dot or something like that. So there's a scalar product between the two, p and q, right? Maybe I'm saying nonsense. Let me think about it. Okay, but yeah, it's a complicated object. The Legendre transformation is something which maps functions on the tangent bundle to functions on the cotangent bundle, and it's non-trivial. Maybe I should prepare this more carefully. All right. Very good. So have you talked about hidden symmetries in classical physics? You haven't. Okay, so let me not go there. Okay, so there is a canonical projection which basically tells you, well, if I am in the tangent bundle, I can project, you know, these coordinates that I forget about the vector part. So canonical projection tells you, well, I forget about this part and just gives you the x mu, or similarly there. And it's used for distinguishing hidden symmetries from normal symmetries in classical mechanics. But if you hadn't done that, don't worry about it. Okay. So then let's do a general tensor. So definition. Tensor of type K and L of rank K plus L. So there's a type of tensor and there's a rank of tensor. And the rank is just sum of these two numbers, and type is just these two numbers, is a multilinear map T, and now what it does, it eats some of the vectors, and it eats some of the covectors or cotangent vectors, and produces a number. Okay, so T likes to eat cotangent vectors, T star P and so on, T star P, that is K of those. So it likes to eat K covectors, K cotangent vectors, and L tangent vectors, TP times TP L times, and produces a real number at a point. Okay, so it's a multilinear map and it likes to eat all these things here. Again, if you vary point P, it will be a function. Okay, so it will be a function on the manifold. Okay, and so then you may be interested in, oh no, I didn't do very important thing. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, let me take one step back. Okay, and I didn't discuss, sorry for this, I didn't discuss how the components of omega transform. Okay, let me discuss it here. Sorry for that. So we again know that omega is an invariant object, right? I can write it in one coordinate system as omega mu dx mu, right? But I can change coordinates as well. So I can write it as omega mu, and now I write dx mu as dx mu over dx nu prime dx nu prime. Okay? This thing here is omega nu prime. So the components of the cotangent vector transform in this way. So omega nu prime is equal to dx mu dx nu prime omega mu. Okay. So I should have discussed this. So now if you look at how the components of the vector transform, the prime thing here is on the top. You have dx prime over dx. If you look at how the components of the covector transform, you have dx over dx prime. It's the vice versa than for the vector. Okay. So now it's super simple to show that this transformation is inverse to that transformation. Right? So the covectors, the components of the covector transform inversely to components of the vector. So then if you look at the components of the tensor, it will, they will precisely transform as, you know, that many components of the covector and that many components of the vector. So if you have, so this will have lots of indices, and there will be t prime, alpha, many more indices, mu, many more indices. So I have this index, which is like the vector index, this index, which is like the covector index or cotangent vector index. And this will be simply given by this thing here transformed as a vector. So there will be prime up dx delta and so on. And then this thing transform with a prime down. T delta and kappa. Okay, so these are how the components of a tensor transform. Okay, let's have a 3-minute break, and then we'll finish with the tensors and move to something more interesting. Okay? Questions in the meantime. So one of the bases is like the partial derivative basis, the other basis is like a differential derivative basis. Yes?
Is there any reason we are using the differential for the dual basis?
That we are using?
Is there any reason we are using the differential, the dx? I mean, I understand the motivation for using the partial derivative is the Leibniz rule. Is there any motivation for using the dx?
There is. The d is an exterior derivative, and it acts on functions, and it produces forms and stuff like that. You will discuss that in the course with Ruth Gregory on gravitational physics if you take that course after Christmas. So she will explain why you are using the d notation there. The d, what that really stands for, is a, like an exterior derivative. It's a special kind of derivative acting. Yeah, there's a reason for that. Okay, there's a reason for that. But so far it's very far away, okay?
David?
Yes?
Another question. So we've talked about how components transform, but then assuming the basis vectors, they would transform inversely, the components.
Yeah, so you see precisely, you know, what you are doing here is we are really transforming the basis, right? I know that the dx mu, when written in terms of dx nu prime, I'm using this, you know, this thing here. So what really changes is the basis, right?
How did we know that?
Here I'm telling you, it transforms as a differential.
Okay.
Right? And so we are just using how the differential transforms.
Yeah.
I haven't proved it, right? Ruth will prove it, maybe, right? But you know, this is intuitive. Like, if I write d, this is what you would write, right? So and the statement is it is designed in such a way that, you know, this is the right answer,
okay.
Right? But then, you know, what really transforms is the basis. But you can also say, well, I just write it, you know, I just understand this as a new component, and then you can equivalently say, well, actually, my component is changing, right? So that's what people typically do. Like that they work with components, right? And so basically, if you are transforming components of the vector from, let's say, Cartesian coordinates to spherical coordinates, you have to do two things. You have to calculate what this matrix dx over dx prime is, right? So that, you know, that's a matrix which multiplies your vector like here. But you also have to change the coordinates actually from Cartesian to spherical or whatever, in the result. If you had a scalar function, all you had to do was to change the Cartesian to spherical coordinates, but the matrix which you multiplied by that was one. There was no matrix standing in front of that. Here, suddenly, you have a matrix. For tensor, you have many matrices here, one matrix for each index, right? And so you have to multiply these, you know, with the matrices there. For spinners, there will be a different matrix, right? So spinner also will be a like a vector, sort of, right? And there will be a different matrix. Yes?
Does any of this make sense if we don't have a metric apparently?
So far, if we don't have a metric, then?
Like, if we don't have a metric.
We don't have a metric yet. We don't have a metric. For anything we are discussing here, we don't have a metric. Not yet. So all this. So that's why we are distinguishing the vector from the cotangent vector and stuff, normal vector from this covector and stuff like that. If you have a metric, you don't have to do that, right? Because you can always map to one to another, right? But so far we don't have a metric. We pretend not to have metric. This is just pure differential geometry. Well, how far you can get without having a metric, if you want. Yeah.
I don't really understand the relationship between all of our calculations and the word geometry. I mean, the only part that's related to geometry is that we defined this on the manifold, and this is like just visualization. I mean, there is geometry here. There are just some algebras defining vectors. You know what I'm saying? I'm just...
Okay. So differential, because we will be able to differentiate these objects. Okay, so we will be doing that in maybe 10 minutes, but okay. So I'll show you how to differentiate these objects. So that's why differential geometry. But geometry, like really here, is like, yes, you are talking about vectors and, you know, whatever, but from this algebraic point of view, you're right. Yeah. Yeah. Delete this one. All right, so welcome back. So let's finish with the tensors. So I already told you about tensor is a multilinear map which likes to eat vectors and covectors, or cotangent vectors, tangent vectors, and cotangent vectors, and produces a number at a point, or a function if you go throughout the manifold. This is how the tensor transforms. Basically, each index of the tensor, so these are the components of the tensor, and they transform according to, like, if you have index up, it transforms as a vector index. If you have index down, it transforms as a cotangent vector index, okay? But of course, if you want to talk about the invariant object, T, and let's say I have a tensor with three indices, alpha, beta, gamma, or whatever. So these are the components of that tensor. And then has to be also the corresponding basis. So there will be D over dx alpha basis, but there also will be this basis, and there will be that basis. Okay, and so this is now the basis of the tensors of rank 1 and 2, rank 3 of the type 1 and 2 here, and so this is the corresponding basis. So now you see that I use this thing here for a tensor product between the bases. Like, you can use it to if you have one basis and you tensor product it with other basis, you use it to create tensors of higher and higher rank. Okay. By the way, what these components are, they are simply the tensor, invariant object tensor T, evaluated on the corresponding basis. So it will be evaluated on D X alpha D over D X beta D over D X gamma. Okay, so this is what it is. So tensor of this type, it likes to eat forms. So it will be one form which it eats, and there will be two vectors which it eats and produces a number, and this is the corresponding number. Okay. You can prove this as your homework. Oh, is it obvious? It's obvious, right? I just plug in for this T here, I use this T here, and I act on these things here. But of course, these are just the numbers, so I can take them out, and then I really act with this thing here on that thing there, this thing here on that thing there, this thing here on that thing there, and that gives me always delta, and that's why this is true. Okay? Very good. So now, finally, let me say what a tensor algebra is, what you can do with tensors. So these are tensor algebra. And so first what you can do is that you can add tensors if they are of the same type. Okay, so you can do T plus S if T and S are of the same type. Which means you can add two vectors, but you cannot add vector to a cotangent vector and so on. Right? So they have to be of the same type. Right? So second, there is a tensor product. This thing here, which makes bigger tensors. So you have T and S, so then you will have T times S, and this will be a bigger tensor. And the way how you do it is basically, let's say I have, for example, that's the best thing here. We can do so. Let's say T is T alpha beta D over DX alpha times DX beta. So let's say that's my T. And let's just do very simple S. S is just S kappa DX kappa. So let's have this example. So we have a rank 2 tensor here. And then we have rank 1 tensor here. This is the one form or cotangent vector. And this is a tensor which has one index as a vector, one index as a covector. And then if you do T times S, what you simply do is that you take the components out, because they are just components. So you have T alpha beta S kappa. And then you have to be careful which tensor is first. So I have to use this basis first and then that basis. So D over DX alpha, tensor product DX beta, tensor product DX kappa. Okay, so this is how you do it. And then obviously, so this is my new basis. And this thing here will be my new components. So this will be T times S components, alpha, beta, and kappa. That simple it is, okay? So it's just, but of course, you know, we have to be careful whether it's T times S or S times T may not be the same thing, right? Because this thing here has vector index first, and then it has two form indices. If you reverse it, if you take S times T, well, S will be first, and so the resulting tensor will have one index down, one index up, one index down. It's a different tensor, right? So this is not, if you swap the two, then it's not the same thing. Okay, so we have tensor product, where we can create bigger tensors. So then we have contraction where we can create small tensors, And let me again do this example here. So what it basically does is that you say, well, if I have a tensor, as we had before, T, which was T alpha beta, T over dx alpha, tensor dx beta. So whether we have two indices, which, you know, when one is up and one is down, you can say, well, these two indices are the same. I can sum over them, OK? And so then T contraction will be just T alpha alpha. And basically what you are doing is that you act with this basis on that basis. So how you do that, let me do it slowly. T alpha beta, and then what you do is that you act with this guy on that guy. So it's T x beta x on D over dx alpha. You contract alpha and beta index here. So you act with a form on a vector, right? This gives you delta alpha beta, delta beta alpha. And so this gives you T alpha alpha, right? So basically the contraction just, you know, whenever we have one index up and one index down, I can contract them, I can sum over them. And the way how it is done is that you basically act with the corresponding basis vector on the corresponding basis vector. And this is how you get it.
Have we anywhere here implicitly assumed Euclidean metric?
There's no metric.
There's no metric.
No metric here. So that's why you can only contract. Very good. Thank you for that question. Very important. That's why you can only contract one index up and one index down. You cannot contract two indices which are up or two indices which are down at this point, because there's no way to lower one of them. And so there's no way how you could act with.
So when we talk about raising and lowering indices, that's when we introduce the metric.
Exactly. But so far, no raising or lowering indices. OK? So it's only possible. So thank you so much for that question. Only possible for a mix of up and down indices, right? So you cannot contract two upper indices or two down indices at this point. Always has to be one up and one down, and you can contract them. Yes?
Like really no metric, or are we assuming that I...
There's no metric here. No metric. At this point, no metric.
Okay.
Of course, for for general relativity, we will need metric, right? So metric will be our building block for gravity. So metric is the gravity, right? But at this point, we're just doing differential geometry. Well, actually, geometry, not differential yet. And for that, you don't need metric. We're just discussing what kind of objects we can put on the manifold. And we are just putting some tensors on the manifold, some vectors on the manifold, and so on. But we haven't put the metric yet. Okay. And that's it. So basically, these are the three operations you can do with tensors. You can do T plus S. If they are of the same type, you can do a tensor product, making the tensors bigger. You just put, you know, the basis, and you put a tensor product there, and you're creating bigger basis. You're creating bigger vectors, bigger tensors. Or you can actually contract one basis with the corresponding dual basis, and that will contract the two indices here. Okay, and so that's it. So these are the operations with tensors. Questions? Yes.
The definition of T as a multilinear map, shouldn't those also be tensor problems?
So this, not here, right? So what you are really doing is that, what you are thinking about is that you are plugging the tensor. So the tensor is a beast which has several slots. And what it's telling you, well, I have to feed that many slots with vectors. I don't know, V1, V2, and whatever. And then that many slots with covectors, right? And so it's not a tensor product here. It will be a tensor product when you talk about the basis, right? But this is like, you know, I am just mapping, you know, that many things to a number. Okay.
Can I ask something?
Yes.
Can we also make contractions with, for example, the Levitt-Schwitter
symbol? Oh, we have no Levitt-Schwitter symbol yet. Okay. We will have, but for that you need metric. Okay. So we will discuss Levitt-Schwitter symbol when we have metric. Wait. Next lecture, maybe. Lecture afterwards. Yes.
So, like we had vector fields, we also have cotangent vector fields.
Uh huh. Yes. Exactly. So basically, maybe I wasn't clear enough. So, like, you can start with discussing with a vector at a point, right? And it's something which maps a function to a real number, right? But then you can extend this to the whole of manifold by saying I run over all the points there in the manifold. And so then I have V of F running through all the points. It's a function, new function on the manifold. And this better be nice and smooth and whatever, right? So the same thing for the cotangent vectors. So again, you can do omega at a point, which will be something which eats vectors at that point, produces a real number. Or it runs around the whole manifold. It eats vectors everywhere on the manifold. And then you have a function on that manifold, which better be nice and smooth. OK, we have 10 minutes for covariant differentiation. So let's just see what the problem may be. OK? So part C will be connection. OK, so we can put tensors on the manifold. The question is, well, we want to write down differential equation for our fields and stuff like that, for the gravitational field. So we need to be able to differentiate tensors. Okay, so we want to write down differential equations. However, differentiation on the manifold may be a little bit more complicated than the one you know from multidimensional calculus. Okay, so what the problem is. So connection, we want to differentiate tensors. And what we would like is that when you differentiate your tensor, you also get a tensor, something that is, again, invariant on the manifold, right? So that's the whole point. If it's not invariant anymore on the manifold, then you've done something strange. Suddenly, your result depends on the coordinate system you are using, right? But you don't want that, OK? So we want to differentiate tensors to produce new tensors, OK? So now, remind yourself how you do that for the calculus of one variable. So you define a derivative of the function with respect to t at point t0 to be a limit as goes to 0 f of t0 plus s minus f of t0 divided by s. OK, so this is how you define differentiation of objects in one-dimensional calculus. So now, what is immediately the problem? So there's two problems, right? So I want to differentiate now, let's say, tensors, right? I want to differentiate vectors. I want to differentiate covectors. I want to differentiate tensors, and so on. So now, what is this t0 plus s and t0? So I can see when I think start thinking about things on the manifold, I can replace t0 by point p on the manifold. I want the derivative at point p, right? So t0 would then correspond to point p on the manifold. And then t0 plus s, well, it corresponds to some point p plus delta p on the manifold. So first of all, what is this? Okay, what is this? That's the first question. Which way on the manifold do you move? How do you compare things on the manifold, like from, you know, going from one point to another on the manifold? So that's the first problem. But even more importantly, here, the function, well, it happily lives on this, you know, real line or whatever. And the real line is the same everywhere. But we just learned that, for example, if you want to differentiate vectors, do I still have the picture, or that's the only one? Can you see that picture over there? So we have two vectors. Well, so we have vector field at point P, and we have vector field at point Q. But each of them lives in a different tangent space. So V at P lives in a different space than V at Q. So how do I compare their values when they live in a different space? How do I subtract them? So the second problem is, so this is the first problem, how really you talk about like where do you move on the manifold? And the second problem is how to compare, for example. So this problem will not be a problem of a function. It will, the function will be OK. Function is OK. But if I talk about vectors or covectors, they live in different spaces. How to compare V at P and V at P plus delta P when they live in different spaces? How do I subtract them? And so on. Okay? And that's a big problem. I don't know how to do that. And so that's why differentiation on manifolds is a little bit more complicated than differentiation over here. So now, interestingly, people developed three different basic things how to differentiate objects on the manifold. We have three possibilities. Okay, so there are three standard possibilities how to resolve these problems. So one of them, the simplest one of them all, is called Lie derivative. It's called Lie derivative. What it does, it actually needs an additional input of a vector field. So needs a vector field U, which is an input of your derivative. Basically, what that vector field tells you is, it tells you, well, the vector field is sort of nice and smooth on the manifold. The vector field can be a tangent vector to some curve on that manifold. The curve is uniquely defined, because it's so you are basically asking, is there a curve so that this vector field is always tangent to that curve? And there will be one such curve, okay? And so then you can move along this curve, and you can say, well, now actually I'm at this point P, which is the curve at one parameter, and then I have P plus delta P, which will be a curve in slightly later parameter or whatever. So it immediately resolves this problem, what P plus delta P is. But moreover, I can use this curve to drag my vector field from one point to another point. Once I drag that field from one point to another point, I can compare the vector field which I dragged there with whatever was already there, and that gives me the difference. Right? So this is the simplest and nicest way, but the input is that you need to have a vector field u on that manifold, and you can differentiate only along this vector field u. Okay? So it's the simplest. But because it's the simplest, we are not going to discuss it. Okay? Wait for Ruskos course. Okay. There's another thing which is called exterior derivative. This is maybe even simpler than this one. You don't need any extra structure. However, this derivative is not good for tensors in general. It only works on antisymmetric tensors. Only works on antisymmetric tensors. So for example, if you have electromagnetism described by f mu nu, f mu nu is an antisymmetric tensor, right? So you can apply derivative to this f mu nu, which will be the exterior derivative, and you don't need any additional structure. No need for additional structure. So this one is let's say, even simpler than this one, sort of. But it only works on certain objects. It doesn't work for all tensors. It's not good for GR. That's why we are not going to discuss it. If you're interested, see Ruse's course, OK? Again, Ruse will discuss this. So now, the third one, and the most complicated one, is the covariant derivative. It's the most complicated of them all, OK? Covariant derivative. The most complicated. Because it needs a very complicated extra structure. The extra structure is called connection. Okay? Needs connection. Connection. And the connection will be a beast with three indices, gamma, alpha, beta, gamma. Okay, it's not the Christoffel symbol, which we have seen already. It might be. Christoffel symbol is one possibility, but it's not the most general possibility. There is much more general thing. So if you have connection, you have this beast with three indices, you can define covariant derivative. This will act on any tensor you want. We will need it for general relativity. Okay, so we will be using covariant derivative. But it's the most complicated of the all three possibilities. So remember, just to resolve here, let's discuss the connection next time. But there are three possibilities. One of them doesn't need any extra structure and on the manifold, which is the exterior derivative. But it only works for a subset of tensors, very, very special subset of tensors. It doesn't work for general tensors. It will be good for electromagnetism, sort of, but it's not good for gravity. Okay, lead derivative needs a vector field on the manifold. You need to know some kind of vector field, and then you can differentiate along this vector field. Okay, in some sense, it's the simplest derivative you can think about, with this, you know, provided that you are given the vector field. But it's not good for formulating general relativity equations. So for that, we need covariant derivative, and it's the most complicated one, where you need this connection extra structure. So let's discuss what the connection is next time. Questions? Yes.
Yeah. Could you elaborate why the derivative is bad? Like why
is it bad?
Yeah. Why is it bad?
Oh, it's good. It's very nice.
Yeah. Why the vector field is so strict?
No. The lead derivative is very, very nice, and it is good for discussing symmetries and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So for example, what you are really doing is that you can think about it like. you are dragging the objects, the tensors, which you have on your manifold along that vector field.
Yeah.
So I drag, let's say I start with a vector here, or with a tensor, whatever, metric. I start with a metric here, and I drag it along the vector field. And then I look, I dragged it somewhere, and then I look, I had my metric there already, which was the metrics defined everywhere, right? So there was an original metric there. Now I dragged the new one there, and I compare the two. I may find out that they are the same. If they are the same, then what it means is that the metric is not changing along this direction of the vector field. If it's not changing, it means there is some kind of symmetry to the metric, right? And I have symmetry. I will have, you know, another theorem. I will have some conserved quantities and so on. So Lie derivative very important for discussing symmetries, for discussing things like there may be very special directions in your spacetime where nothing is changing, where everything remains the same as you would like. So then you have symmetries and things like that. So Lie derivative very, very important for discussing symmetries and other things. Unfortunately, for writing down the Einstein equations, we need a covariant derivative.
But in the case that the vector field exists and is well defined, they coincide, right? The covariant derivative, or?
Not exactly coincide, but yes, you can write down. So Lie derivative doesn't depend on connection, okay? But you can write it in terms of the covariant derivative as well, in such a way that the connection in terms will in the end drop out. But yes, you can write it in terms of the covariant derivatives and stuff like that. But basically what you are doing with this vector field is that you are sort of contracting the simplest one. So Lie derivative of a function is just a directional derivative of this vector field. So it'll be u mu d mu of f. So this is how you define it, df over dx mu, right? So it's a directional derivative as you know it. So in this case, it's the same thing as if you contracted u mu with the covariant derivative acting on f, it's the same thing, right? But so there's always this contraction with the vector field sort of in the Lie derivative. But yeah, you can forget about that. And in certain cases, you know, this thing here will be the same as the covariant derivative, but in other cases, it won't. Yeah.
I have an additional question.
Yes.
Wasn't dx corresponded to cotangent vector space in the very above t alpha beta gamma? I didn't understand why we are, because the alpha is for tangent vector space, right? So.
Yeah, are you talking about the leftmost uppermost formula there? Yeah, right. So you have the so your tensor is rank 3 tensor, and it behaves like this in one index. The first index behaves like a vector index, and then you have two indices which behave like covector indices, right? So in that case, really the basis is like t alpha d over dx alpha, right? So that's the first part of that, and then you have t beta gamma, where the basis is dx beta times dx gamma.
Yes, but the notation dx is correspondent to cotangent vector space, right?
That's right, yes.
So for the second line, it would be t, partial derivative with respect to alpha and dx beta dx gamma, right? Because beta gamma is cotangent space, right?
Try it. So what do you want to do? So this is a statement, right? I'm saying the components can be got by the fact that yes, you are finding you are feeding the vector t these three vector covector vector, right? Okay. So what you do is that you apply now you plug for the t this thing here, right? And how that works is that. So I have t alpha beta gamma is just a number which is in front of that. And then I have t over dx alpha is the first slot acting on this guy here.
Okay.
That gives me a number. This gives me, I should be changing indices, right? But anyway, it gives me one. It gives me one here. And then this thing here, x on that thing, it gives me one. And this thing here, x on that thing, gives me one. And so whatever stands before is actually what I want to prove.